Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Thursday, September 15th, 2016. People like me who are self-employed have to send some money to Washington and the state tax people, too, today. This podcast, the free podcast, is now available daily on YouTube. Just another way for you to capture the Peter B. Collins podcast. Well, last night I stayed up late and went out to the movie theater to watch the premiere nationwide of Oliver Stone's new feature film called Snowden. And I was very pleased with what I saw. Now, you can take issue with Hollywood dramatizations of real-life stories, and Oliver Stone himself pushes back when journalists like Jason Leopold ask him for a political interpretation or evaluation of what he's done. I'm a dramatist, he says. I look for a story, and I believe that there's a lot that people didn't know about Ed Snowden that this film brings, and it's true. Part of it, I think, goes a little too deep into Ed Snowden's personal relationship with his girlfriend of 10 years, Lindsay Mills, but it does add an important human dimension. And I really felt empathy for her, what it must be like to live with somebody whose entire work life is secret. And you have to trust that person when they go away, when they, work long hours. And that does take a toll on a personal relationship. And we got to know her beyond the limited reports that she likes to dance on a stripper pole and has some cute pictures of herself out there on the internet. But in this 2-hour major motion picture, Oliver Stone takes us through Ed Snowden's career. And we learn quite a bit that has been really de minimis in the story that we know so far. For example, he worked for the CIA, and despite the fact that he did not complete high school, much less have any advanced degree, Ed Snowden was such a whiz, so skilled with computer technology, that in the class that he took at the CIA, he completed a task in 45 minutes that other people took hours to complete. And so, one of the things, as Jason Leopold points out, and this is an excerpt from my latest in-depth interview that's released to our subscribers today. Ed Snowden was not a low-level analyst or just a hacker, as Obama has dismissed him. He was a high-level operative, first at the CIA and then as a contractor for the CIA and the NSA. Here's Jason Leopold.
The movie really does show that Snowden was high-level at the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's still sort of something that we don't exactly have enough details about, because the NSA and the government, the administration, continues to claim that he was a low-level analyst, that he was not involved in the creation of any high-level programs, managing high-level programs. But the movie, I think, does a fantastic job of showing his, what his expertise was and how he actually came to, how he was actually able to acquire all of these documents, all of these highly classified documents.
That's Jason Leopold commenting on Ed Snowden and the new Oliver Stone film. And in just a second, I'll tell you more about my latest in-depth interview with Jason Leopold. But what's fascinating is that Ed Snowden wrote a piece of code that he thought was backup, and he didn't think it would ever be used. And as the film progresses, he learns to his dismay that the code he wrote was put into service as a primary code used by the CIA in conducting drone strikes. And the implication from the film is that Snowden took pretty personally and was deeply affected by the carnage caused by American unmanned aerial vehicles. And so I found that very interesting. And I will relate to you that Bill Binney, who is basically depicted in the film as a composite character played by Nicolas Cage, well, Bill Binney was a high-ranking technical official at the NSA before he split way back in 2001 after the 9/11 changes became evident to him and others who departed at that time. And Bill Binney has told me that he believes this film is technically quite accurate. And I think that's important because in some of the scenes, Snowden and a co-worker walk us through X keystroke, and they demonstrate how they can get all kinds of information from your phone calls, your Facebook, and that court orders are just a rubber stamp that nobody bothers to get. And we learn about the radicalization of Ed Snowden and the pivotal event when he saw the top spook, James Clapper, perjure himself under oath before the Senate, and of course it was broadcast on television. And the scene that is depicted is Snowden and some other NSA employees and contractors in Hawaii who see James Clapper make this whopper of a lie. And they are, you know, despite the context, they quietly note that this is a lie. And then, of course, they say, better not make any waves. Not going to make too big a deal out of this. But, of course, Ed Snowden did. So I think it's well worth seeing. I also got to see a video link where Ed Snowden joined the filmmaker and the two lead actors of the film, and there were some interesting comments from that session, most notably that Thomas Drake, the NSA whistleblower, who was subjected to a draconian prosecution under the Espionage Act and now works, I mean, he was making $200,000 a year, one of the top people at the NSA, and he now works as a genius at an Apple store in suburban Washington. Tom Drake was there. I believe it was in New York where Stone and the actors were. And Ed Snowden praised him in the video link from Moscow and said that it was the trail that was blazed by the other whistleblowers that led him to operate in the manner that he did. So I talked to Jason Leopold about the Snowden film, about the new lawsuit that he has filed against the IRS demanding release of Donald Trump's audit files from his tax returns. We also discussed the Hillary Clinton email scandal. There are four more batches of the emails that were deleted under a claim that they were not work-related, but they were found to be work-related by the FBI in its investigation. That amounts to almost 15,000 emails, and one of the DVDs that those emails were stored on is described as entirely classified information. We also spend quite a bit of our interview talking about the blockbuster series published by The Guardian in the past week and written by Spencer Ackerman, a very talented writer, who properly credits Jason Leopold for some of his achievements in getting documents and information about what became a constitutional crisis when the Senate Intelligence Committee review of the CIA torture programs led to a showdown over the so-called Panetta Review. And I think that that part of the conversation is very valuable, and I hope that our subscribers will check it out. And while I'm talking about subscribers, let's get to this already today. I want to thank the people who support me with your subscriptions, people like Carla Mahoney, Carl Howard, Tim McKay, and Tim McKay, well, Tim McKay's got two subscriptions. Maybe that's intentional, maybe not, Tim. Let me know. But I appreciate the support of listeners like you. And if you're not a subscriber, come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and you can do it in just a couple of minutes. Mentioning Jason Leopold, his latest article for Vice News relates to the report coming from the Director of National Intelligence. And this is supposed to tell us about how letting people out of Guantanamo is a bad idea because they, quote-unquote, return to the battlefield. Well, what we're learning is that the latest report shows that a total of four, two prisoners who were released by Obama and at least two more who were released by Bush years ago, have been reported to returning to terrorist activities in the first months of 2016. Now, when you put it in perspective, this is a very minor percentage. Of those who were released by Bush, about 14% are suspected of, quote, re-engaging, where those who've been released by Obama have re-offended or re-engaged at a rate of under 7%. And this is supposed to scare us into joining Republicans and some Democrats who don't want to close Guantanamo. They don't want to release any more people. Even the 20 individuals who've been cleared for release because they can't be charged or tried, because they're not guilty of any terrorism-related offense. Or they were tortured, and we can't use hearsay evidence against them. So it's just more public relations. And they're claiming now that the terminology used here for re-engaging does not include people who speak out against the United States just verbally. They have to be involved in various activities, but this is a very subjective effort. There is no exact standard for determining what re-engagement means, and we believe, or at least I believe, this was released to try to influence the vote in the House. There was 244 to 174 in a bill that seeks to prohibit the government from using funds to transfer any more prisoners out of Guantanamo. Now, the White House says Obama will veto it, but he has not done that in the past, and we'll see how that plays out. Elizabeth Warren is, she's got her fighting gloves on. She's written a pair of letters to the FBI director and to the Department of Justice Inspector General saying, hey, you remember the Angelides Commission that investigated the criminal activity on Wall Street that led to the meltdown in 2008? Well, it identified 14 banks and 9 individuals as deserving further investigation and prosecution. And not a single of the 9 individuals has been brought to justice, as we say. And I believe 5 of the 14 banks have paid fines in these civil settlements that I certainly don't approve of. And it's interesting to see that Robert Rubin, a former Clinton administration official, was one of the people identified for possible prosecution. He's the chair over at Citigroup. They also mentioned people like Stan O'Neill and Jeffrey Edwards of Merrill Lynch. And over at Citigroup, the CEO, Chuck Prince, the CFO, and the board chairman. None of these people have faced any consequences for the failures that they visited on the American people. And they are also, the FCIC, that investigation that was run by Angelides, presented the DOJ with evidence that these institutions gave false representations about loan quality, misled credit rating agencies, overstated assets, your basic elements of fraud. But those banks are too big to fail, and the people who run them are too cool to jail. Speaking of the Inspector General, the one over at Justice has just exonerated the FBI. And this is the equivalent of the FBI investigating the FBI, as it always does. And this comes out of a 2007 case in Washington State near Seattle, where a high school student suspected of an intent to bomb the school was faked out by the FBI. They used a software tool called a Computer and Internet Protocol Address Verifier, and they sent private messages to an account associated with the 15-year-old bomb threat suspect. And the message contained a link to a phony AP story about bomb threats posted on a fake Seattle Times webpage. So here, the FBI ruse was to pose as a media outlet and to present false information attributed to a major media organization. And this is now a violation of FBI policy. But in 2007, the issue was unaddressed, and over at the Justice Department, they say that the technique was proper and appropriate at the time, but today, use of such an unusual technique would probably require higher-level approvals. There's been another shooting of a young boy. I believe he's African-American. This occurred in Columbus, Ohio last night. And I was first tipped to this in a Facebook post from my friend Bob Fetrakis. Bob is an attorney and activist based in Columbus. He is an election protection advocate who has informed us of many of the threats to our election system. And he also is a perennial candidate running as a Green Party activist. And right now, he is running to serve as the prosecutor in Franklin County, which is the county where the state capital, Columbus, is located. And on Facebook, he said, "Very disturbed to find out. While I'm speaking at the People's Justice Project Candidate Forum on excessive use of force by the Columbus police and police shootings of black people, I find out that this happened less than a block away from my house." And the incident involved this 13-year-old boy who appeared to be packing a BB gun. And the BB gun had a laser guidance. You've seen these things, right? It helps you target. And the officer mistook the BB gun for a lethal firearm, shot the boy multiple times, and he died later in a Columbus Children's Hospital. Details? Well, they say officers were responding to a robbery report in which several people, one carrying a gun, approached a man and demanded money. And cops said they spotted three people, including Tyree King, who matched a description of the robbers. Now, I'm skeptical of this right now because it's hard to imagine that a 13-year-old boy matched that description, but we'll hold that for now. So they approached the group. Tyree and one of the companions fled, and police said, and we've heard this so many times, he was shot multiple times after allegedly pulling the BB gun from his waistband. I'm pausing just to reflect on how tragic this is. And how hard it is to believe the police. They might be telling the truth, but I'm conditioned to be skeptical. And the experience in Cleveland of Tamir Rice and his family, my own experience growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, it informs that suspicion. Sandra Bland's family has finally negotiated a settlement with the Waller County, Texas authorities, where Sandra was unnecessarily pulled over by a cop. The altercation ensued. She was then hustled out of her car in a brutal fashion after being threatened with a taser. And then she wound up in jail and was found dead. A couple of days later, the jailers claimed suicide. And it is credit to the mother of Sandra Bland, whose name is Geneva Reed Veal. And she insisted not only on the cash settlement, but on reforms at the jail. The conditions include a requirement for sensors to be used to ensure that detainee checks were done accurately, could not be falsified, and the jail has agreed to ensure that there's a duty nurse or emergency medical technician on all shifts. We'll never know how Sandra Bland died. But again, it's hard to trust the official story and believe the police accounts. And finally, in this segment, I want to link you to a powerful op-ed that appeared in the New York Times today, and it is also packaged with a 4-minute video that is narrated by Jay-Z. Let's listen to a minute of it.
In 1986, when I was coming of age, Ronald Reagan doubled down on the war on drugs that had been started by Richard Nixon in 1971. Drugs were bad, fried your brain. And drug dealers were monsters, the sole reason neighborhoods and major cities were failing. No one wanted to talk about Reaganomics and the ending of social safety nets, the defunding of schools and the loss of jobs in cities across America. Young men like me who hustled became the sole villain, and drug addicts lacked moral fortitude. In the 1990s, incarceration rates in the U.S. blew up. Today we imprison more people than any other country in the world. China, Russia, Iran, Cuba. All countries we consider autocratic and repressive.
So I played this part to get you interested. I hope you'll click on the link and watch the entire video. It is an important message about the failure on the war on some drugs. And I'm glad to hear Jay-Z bring this to the public's attention. I think it's well worth watching. Lisa Hajar is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where she is also chair of the Law and Society program. And Lisa, I am very concerned about your colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley. Chancellor Dirks, who is embattled, has resigned but is on the job until the end of the school year, has suspended in the middle of a semester a course that was student-led and focused on the issues between Palestinians and Israel and factors including settler-colonial issues. I find this very alarming that the free speech rights of people who are critical of the state of Israel are being squelched in favor of protecting apparently the ears and other senses of Jewish students.
Yes, I mean, the course itself, Dean, Chancellor Dirks, I think the buck stops with him, but the decision was made, to my knowledge, by Dean Hesse, who's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. And what's particularly alarming about this instance is that the dean and other statements coming out of Berkeley allege that the course, which had begun the week before cancellation, was not subjected to the appropriate vetting. That's actually factually inaccurate. I mean, the course is a, you know, as you mentioned, it's a student-run, one-course, pass-fail course of a program called DECAL, or Democratic California. And it, in fact, went through all of the standard vetting processes for a course of that sort, including approval by the Committee on Course Evaluations, in other words, the Academic Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than this being, I mean, of course, there are free speech issues implicated, but it's more directly a problem of academic freedom, where a dean and or the administration unilaterally asserts a suspension of a course on the basis, the acclaimed basis of procedural irregularities, which are contradicted by the facts themselves, and did so without any consultation whatsoever with either the student instructor or the faculty member of record or any of the normal channels that had approved the course.
Well, Professor, I would defer to you on these academic issues. I'm not an expert on that, but I'm more concerned about the free speech implications. And here is the campus where the free speech movement, Mario Savio, took hold back in the 1960s. And we're now specifying that speech that is pro-Palestinian is subjected to extra review and is subject to essentially veto by powerful Jewish interests who are trying to protect, they say, Jewish students from anti-Semitism. But the construct here and the claim of anti-Semitism is not proven, and it suggests that the critics here, who 43 groups wrote this letter to Chancellor Dirks, that they're able to read the minds of the student who's leading this class and presume that because he's a member of a pro-Palestinian group that his bias is confirmed.
Yes. I mean, indeed, what is, in fact, most alarming about this case is that it seems to have been, the suspension seems to have been in direct and immediate response to the letter that you mentioned by a group called AMCA Initiative and 42 other, and I would characterize them as Zionist or, groups or sort of pro-Israel groups, because certainly there are many Jewish students and organizations that, do not, would not support this kind of outside non-academic efforts to censure academic teaching. And in fact, Jewish Voice for Peace just issued a letter today as an example of a countervailing point. Mm-hmm. But it is, what's going on, and this is, one of many instances in which AMCA Initiative and these other organizations seek, erroneously to conflate analysis and critical study or critical speech about Israeli state policies with anti-Semitism or as presenting, a threat or danger to students. And this seems to be, in terms of what the statements issued by the Berkeley Barkley administration, that they kind of subscribed wholesale to this argument, which has been, you know, on the agenda of AMCA Initiative and others for quite a while, and has been demonstrably disproven, that the critical study of Israel does not have any direct relationship to anti-Semitism on campus. And so, you know, but it is, you know, there's, one can say that there's a very strong and ongoing effort by these organizations to utilize their pressure tactics on administrations, who, in the case of Berkeley, as you know, unfortunately not alone, sort of succumb to this pressure in order to avoid what they regard as perhaps bad press. But in doing what Berkeley has done by suspending this course and literally, you know, sort of parroting the rationale of these non-academic, outside, partisan, agenda-driven organizations, as the university's explanation, is deeply troubling for both free speech and for academic freedom.
And Professor, the signers of this letter include, this is bizarre, Americans for Peace and Tolerance, the Association of Reform Zionists, the Zionist Organization of America, and the Davis Faculty for Israel. Now, how can we have people who are faculty members who define themselves as pro-Israel sign a letter attempting to squelch the speech of people who don't agree with them? This is clearly and fundamentally a violation of the First Amendment.
Absolutely. If you read the letter that AMCA Initiative and these other 42 organizations sent to Chancellor Dirks that prompted the suspension, one can see very clearly, you know, a sort of a long-running agenda. For example, the letter, you know, both takes issue with the analytical framework that the course was designed to explore, which is settler colonialism, which is a well-established, you know, and respected intellectual and academic framework for thinking about socio-political relations. Mm-hmm. But it also specifically names and condemns the fact that the faculty of record, Dr. Hatem Bazian, and one, and another faculty member at Berkeley, Dr. Keith Feldman, who is going to be a guest lecturer for the course, are both signatories to the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. Mm-hmm. And so clearly this kind of a move is part of a much larger and somewhat, I would say, desperate campaign to seek to censure, punish, and shut down the free speech issues relating to BDS. I mean, it's mm-hmm. become something from within the state of Israel, and for those who support Israel as, you know, you know, for example, as, you know, represented by the Netanyahu government, BDS is considered increasingly to be a, quote, strategic threat to Israel. And so this is essentially an offensive type of move targeting college campuses in order to, you know, sort of, you know, tamp down support for BDS, which has been growing, especially on college campuses over the last decade.
Indeed. And this, again, is a violation of my free speech rights. And perhaps you're aware you've been on sabbatical for a year, but the California legislature has passed, and it awaits Governor Brown's signature, AB 2844. Which has been drastically amended since it first was introduced, but it still remains a punishment for California companies that support BDS and want to take contracts of $100,000 a year or more with the state of California. So they're using economic sanctions on people who support sanctions against the state of Israel. And this is a fundamental violation of our constitutional rights. And I just want to add, if you're so inclined, please call or email Governor Brown's office and encourage him to veto AB 2844. But we also saw Governor Cuomo sign an executive order with Jewish leaders surrounding him, and then he joined a parade in Manhattan. And so the grandstanding and the politics of the violations of the First Amendment on behalf of squelching criticism of Israel, I think, present a real clear and present constitutional danger in the United States.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, one could say that all of these kinds of legislative moves, both at the federal level and at state governments and even in local governments, is part of a well-orchestrated political diplomatic move emanating out of Israel itself, out of the Israeli government, seeking to urge lawmakers at various levels to pass this kind of legislation. And the language itself has been formulated. I mean, it is a means of, and so in some sense, it is a means of trying to ensure, sort of the exclusion of speech or activism that the Israeli government itself regards as critical of it, and its supporters in the U.S. as well. This kind of legislation, and of course I have, been part of an organization that has signed, sent a letter to Governor Brown urging not to veto this piece of legislation if it comes to his desk. But it is, in a sense, it's something that we need to realize will create some degree of a constitutional crisis over free speech. And so there's certainly, to the extent that this kind of legislation, whether that which has already been passed in New York or elsewhere, is ever used, it will obviously be the subject of test cases. Mm-hmm. And so coming back to the Berkeley situation, I think that the UC Regents recently passed, after some degree of back and forth, their principles of tolerance and non-discrimination, in which it was finally instituted, the effort that Zionist organizations had made to conflate criticisms of Israel with anti-Semitism, that was sort of removed, following faculty pressure on the UC. And so there's a distinction between anti-Semitism and critiques of Israeli policy or anti-Zionism. But I think that this, the 43 organizations going after the Berkeley course are offering up again their, sort of intellectually unsubstantiable conflation argument in order to test the waters of this relatively new version of the UC Regents' principles. So we're seeing, in other words, there's a lot of back and forth over how to interpret these kinds of issues. And I think frankly, for intellectuals and people knowledgeable about the, situation in the Middle East, it's crucial to insist upon a recognition that the conflation of anti-Semitism per se and critiques of Israel are not supportable.
Indeed. Lisa Hajar, professor of sociology and also chair of the Law and Society Program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the show file for today's podcast, I've included a link to call or email Governor Jerry Brown and advocate for a veto of AB 2844, and I've also included the brief message that I posted in an email to the governor earlier today. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's now available on YouTube. Feel free to share it on Facebook. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.